Our fifth case for this morning is United States against Diggs, 1327-18. Ms. Miller.
May it please the Court, Judith Miller from the University of Chicago Law School Federal Criminal Justice Clinic. Under Mr. Diggs' original sentencing guidelines, he was eligible for a sentence of 214 months once the Commission amended the crack cocaine guidelines and made that amendment retroactive. That's 17 and a half years versus the 23 and a half years he's currently serving.
Well, I don't understand at all why he's eligible for that. What happens in the first sentence is that he gets 282 months, which is 78 months below the bottom of the range, and as I read that, it's because the district court judge exercised his discretion under 3553A to give some discount for the assistance that Mr. Diggs had provided to the government, even though his assistance was not enough to satisfy the government that a substantial assistance motion was appropriate. And so he winds up with this 282-month sentence. Now he comes along with the 3582C motion, and I don't see anything that says that a 3553A sort of adjustment has to be replicated either in month terms or in percentage terms or any other way. As it happens, he got enough of a downward adjustment to wind up, you know, so that the Fair Sentencing Act changes and the guideline ranges don't really help him very much. But they don't hurt him. You know, he's not getting a higher sentence somehow. So I just don't see why there's a problem here.
So our argument is not that he must receive a sentence of 214 months or with the percentage it would be 234 months, I believe. The argument is simply that he must be get under the ex post facto clause. Whatever the sentencing reduction procedure that was in place at the time that he was sentenced or in his offense conduct, they're the same as we argue in the brief, that's what gives him the opportunity for the lower sentence once the commission amends the guidelines.
But this is an interesting concept of ex post facto and one that I have never encountered, because the ex post facto clause certainly protects him against a greater punishment. So as we now know, even in the post-Pew world, even if the sentencing guideline recommended range goes up from year one to year now, that's significant enough that you've got to apply the lower range. But his sentence did not go up by a single minute. His sentence is still the 282 months. And yes, he didn't get the chance at a bigger reduction, but I don't know where there's any authority that would say that's what you're entitled to.
I would look for authority to the Supreme Court's case law in Lintz, Weaver, Garner, Morales. All of those cases deal with situations where the sentence imposed, the term of imprisonment, stays the same. We're not amending the judgment. What the issue in those cases is whether or to what extent a certain sentencing reduction applies. So Weaver and Lintz are really about, they're about sentencing credit reductions.
So is it your position that the sole basis of the 78-month variance in the first sentence, the first sentencing, was Mr. Diggs' cooperation?
That's not our position. It is.
What I need to know is, how do we know how much of the variance was attributable to his cooperation?
That's what the judge said, didn't he?
This was a
gesture in rewarding him for his cooperation.
So the first judge was a man and the second judge was a woman. And the first judge, our position is that it doesn't matter because I'm not making an argument that we should look at the 6.5 years, figure out kind of what's attributable to cooperation and then subtract that off. The point is that under the 2008 or the 2003 version of 1B1.10, the district court was authorized to sentence Mr. Diggs all the way down to whatever the comparable sentencing reduction below the amended guideline range was. The district court doesn't have to do that. The district court, this is Dillon's two-step process. Step one, calculate what is the sentencing range that Mr. Diggs could receive. That's substitute in the new amended guidelines, and then under the version of 1B1.10, under which Mr. Diggs was sentenced and during his offense conduct, you lower the low end of that guideline range all the way down to whatever the comparable sentencing reduction would be. In this case, 214 months.
But 1B1.10 gets amended at the same time the commission is integrating the Fair Sentencing Act into its provisions. And I agree with you. It tightens up a bit on 1B1.10. It says we don't want this to be looked at unless there's been a government substantial assistance motion. But I still don't see, when all is said and done, why that increases Mr. Diggs' original sentence. It just deprives him of a bigger opportunity to have it decreased even more. That it does, no doubt.
Well, the Supreme Court has stated in the four cases that I mentioned, the Weaver, Lance, Morales, Garner, even if all we're talking about is an opportunity for a lower sentence, as long as that opportunity is part of the sentencing regime under which you were sentenced, then that's part of your sentence.
But I'm not sure. First of all, I don't think that makes it an ex post facto problem. I really don't think you can get anywhere with the ex post facto clause. Secondly, they decided how much they were going to open that valve, and they opened it maybe not as much as you wanted. But a 3582 is not a plenary resentencing. We all agree with that. And if it were, then I think you'd actually have a stronger argument, but it isn't.
I'm not trying to interrupt you, Judge Rovner.
No. I'm having a problem, too, and I feel very sad about that. But let's suppose Mr. Diggs was, in fact, entitled to the same variance at the resentencing. Would he be entitled to the exact same amount of months' variance or the same percentage deduction? How would a court know?
Well, so our position is not that he's entitled to receive that variance a second time. All we're asking for is that the district judge be permitted to go below the low end of the guidelines. And that's, if I can address.
So you're asking for an amendment of 1B1.10, mm-hmm. which could happen, and the commission would be able to say, we're going to give you an even bigger opportunity for a reduction, which many of us might like to see, but that they didn't do that.
I'm not asking for an amendment to 1B1.10. It's the commission which changed 1B1.10. We're just asking for the version of 1B1.10 under which Mr. Diggs was sentenced. And that's why this is an ex post facto issue. We're looking to the past. We're not asking for a change. Whether or not it's a good idea is really up to
the
commission.
Well, the first reduction was discretionary. You can see that, right?
Yes.
And since it's discretionary, you're saying it doesn't have to be done again.
Well, all I'm saying is that under 1B1.10, and I hate, I'm really not trying to beat a dead horse, under 1B1.10, the second judge has to have the chance to give a comparable reduction. And this isn't some kind of wild, crazy proposition. I did try to look into sort of what was the actual practice prior to 2011, and it appears to be the case that this is what district courts did all the time. They recognized that comparable reductions were permitted, Sometimes they would go all the way down to the low end of the comparable reduction. Sometimes they wouldn't. I didn't find any evidence of district courts complaining that this was very difficult to do. When you take the original sentences given, they would then look to things like, did the defendant have, you know, disciplinary violations in custody? And I see I'm going into my rebuttal time.
You may save the rest of the time for your rebuttal then. Ms. Bonamici.
Oh, my.
May I please the court? Good morning.
How do you respond to the contention that this places the decision as to whether a defendant may be sentenced to a term of imprisonment below the low end of the guidelines range to the prosecutor? Since the prosecutor, of course, has a discretion, has total discretion to file or not to file a motion noting substantial assistance.
I'm not sure that I completely understand your question there, but with respect to the limitation that's been placed on the retroactive application of the guideline here, what I would say is that Congress determined that the Sentencing Commission should have the authority and the duty to determine whether guidelines amendments should be made, whether they should be made retroactively applicable, and if they are made retroactively applicable, the circumstances under which that should be the case and the amounts by which the courts should be allowed to reduce a defendant's sentence based on an amended guideline. Congress's decision is in force, and the Sentencing Commission has the authority and the duty to make that decision, and the courts and the prosecutor abide by that decision. With respect to whether that's a good decision or a bad decision, or whether we agree with that or don't agree with that, I don't think it's the government's place to comment, but I would say that that decision is something that echoes a provision that's contained in 28 U.S.C. 994, which expressly states that the Sentencing Commission is to take into account circumstances of cooperation. So, I mean, there's a direct congressional statement that directs them in that way. So certainly it's not a decision that's off the reservation in any way whatsoever.
So if we were to synthesize your position into one sentence, it would be, I take it, that there's no constitutional right to have a sentence lowered retroactively when a guideline becomes more favorable.
Well, I would say that, and I would say that the Supreme Court has also said that.
Okay.
So I'd say that based on what the Supreme Court said. And with respect to this particular situation, what you have here is a retroactive application of a new guideline or a new amendment that was not in effect, obviously, at the time of the defendant's sentencing, and was, as Judge Wood pointed out, promulgated at the same time as an amendment to 1B1.10, which designates the circumstances under which retroactive application can be made, and which contained this additional limitation. What the defendant has said is what they're asking for is application of 1B1.10 as it existed at the time of the offense. Well, if that's really true, then what we know is that the defendant is absolutely not entitled to any kind of reduction based on the amendment upon which they rely, which is 750, because A, that wasn't in existence, and B, and more importantly, it wasn't listed in 1B1.10C, which is a provision that's remained unchanged throughout this period and has always listed the amendments to which it applies. And obviously, Amendment 750 was not on the list in 2003, and it was not on the list in 2008. It is on the list now, but it's on the list together with the rest of that same provision, which contains the limitations that the defendants are challenging.
Your position is a package deal. The 1B1.10 amendment is in a sense a qualification to the 750.
Absolutely. And it doesn't matter that it is a qualification to amendments other than and in addition to 750. The fact is that it is a qualification to 750. And aside from that, the overall scheme that we're talking about here is by in no way penal at all. As you point out, Judge Wood, this is a scheme that allows not for increased punishment, but for a retroactive after-the-fact application of leniency. Not only does not violate the ex post facto clause, it doesn't even implicate ex post facto concerns.
So it's a strange position for the government to be in, though, because there have been statements from the Attorney General, there have been actions by Congress in the form of the Fair Sentencing Act, and there's other legislation pending, all pointing the direction these draconian 282-month sentences and the like that we see are ill-advised, and yet here you are, you know, defending a 282-month sentence when there might be some way of reading the statutes and the guidelines for a more flexible result.
Well, actually, I'm not defending the sentence in particular. I'm defending the concept that, or the statute that permits a sentencing commission to make these determinations. That is something that Congress has done. It's not something that the government has done. It's not something the courts have done. It is, and it stands appropriately here because what we're talking about here really doesn't implicate the kind of fair notice concerns that are at the core of ex post facto. You're talking about an amendment here that was not in existence at the time of the defendant's offense.
Or his sentencing, for that matter.
Yes. Pardon me?
Or
his
sentencing, for that
correct.
Matter.
Yes. Correct. And you're talking about a provision of law that at all times, all relevant times, from the time that defendant committed his sentence to now, has always been cabined by Congress and limited to the circumstances that the Sentencing Commission determined were appropriate. So there is no fair notice problem here at all. That's one thing that's clear. And the other thing is that Dillon has made very clear, as you point out also, Judge, that 3582 proceedings are not plenary sentencings, and there are no Sixth Amendment concerns at issue here, and there is no right to the district courts being permitted to exercise its discretion in the context of such a proceeding. So the law is what it is, and those core aspects of this law have never changed. There's no difference. So there really is no way that we can look at the circumstance and engage in the fiction that the defendant could depend on the legislative actions of Congress here at the time that he committed his offense, other than to depend on the fact that he could not expect retroactive application of subsequent ameliorative guidelines amendments, and he could not expect to be eligible for such retroactive application, and even more importantly, given the limited circumstances we're dealing with here, he certainly could not expect that in the context of such retroactive application, he would have a right to seek a comparable reduction.
Well, he would have an expectation that 1B1.10 wouldn't be changed. I mean, if they hadn't changed that, then I take it the district court would have been able to take a look and see whether some additional discount, maybe not 78 months, but something.
Well, that's true, but if they hadn't changed it, they wouldn't have added 750 to the list.
Well,
and
we
so,
do we know that?
But, well, no, but my point is if it's unchanged, it's unchanged as a whole.
They could have added 750 to the list and left 1B1.10 alone.
They could, although if you look at the circumstances of the way this law is developed, they always had carved out an exception for substantial assistance, downward departures, or downward departures in a general sense. And then, you know, post-Booker, when we're in the world of variances, they started by saying, normally we do not think of variance as something that should carry over with these applications of the amendments to these reductions, and then they stopped it. So for all of these reasons and the reasons stated in our brief, Your Honors, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Ms. Miller?
Yes, Your Honor.
this case is not about a right to a lower sentence. It's only about whether Mr. Diggs is eligible for a lower sentence, whether the sentencing reduction proceedings in place at either the time of his offense or the time of his sentencing whether the ex post facto clause applies to them, and we think it does. Now, I do want to point out a few responses to opposing counsel's argument. In Dillon, the Supreme Court relied on the old version of 1B1.10, and if you go back and read Dillon, you'll see that the Supreme Court is reading 1B1.10, the old version, the one which helps Mr. Diggs, right alongside 3582. Frankly, if you read the decision, nobody contemplated that the commission was going to take action like this. And so I think that there is it's maybe somewhat tenuous, but there is, I question how applicable Dillon continues to be once 1B1.10 is changed. Now, that's not the issue in this case. I raise it only because in response to opposing counsel. But it is worth going back and looking at Dillon and seeing the extent to which the Supreme Court really reads these two things together. I would also note Amendment 759, it's not a single integrated amendment. It lists several things. They're separate issues. One change is constitutional. Another change is not. As is usual in constitutional litigation, I'm asking the court to sever these two, strike down the unconstitutional one as applied to Mr. Diggs, and the constitutional one, of course, we have no problem with that. And as to the prosecutor's total discretion, this goes to the fair notice issue. Mr. Diggs' attorney would have had the right to ask the judge to force the prosecutor to make a 5K motion. The judge had already told The judge had already told the parties that he would be considering cooperation under 3553A. So Mr. Diggs' attorney had no reason to do that. Of course, now we see there are immense sentencing consequences for a decision that he made that may well have been reasonable at the time. And for these and the reasons stated in the briefs, we'd ask the court to vacate the district court's decision.
Okay, thank you very much. And we appreciate the efforts of the clinic for your client. And thanks, of course, as always, to the government. We'll take the case under advisement.